All right, let's invite Jesus to lead this time. Father, Lord, we invite you to come and to watch over our hearts and minds in a way that would allow us to hear the things that you want us to hear, to see the things you want us to see, and to discern the meanings of those things in a way that you want to apply them to our lives. And Lord, I thank you for the really encouraging times that I had at least yesterday and hearing the responses of people, and I do pray now that we would be able to get a little bit deeper, a little bit clearer in how we can understand the changes that are taking place around us as well as in us, as well as how we can better apply these things in our lives and the work that you've given us to do. We thank you that all our work is worship, and all our worship is service, and all our service is work unto your glory. So come again and lead us, we ask, Jesus. Amen. Amen. All right. Well, you can see the title there. Little reminder. What's the Hebrew word? Avda. Okay. Very, very good. Well, we've got some... Oh, I've got to work on here. Golly, I got to keep remembering. How are we doing here? All right, it's working. I mean, Sun Young has done a fabulous job back there of wiring this up and getting things working. You know, I showed up. I don't use Mac because my wife, who's an IT person, she majored in computers back in 1978 when nobody was doing computers. And so she does all our computer stuff, and she doesn't like Mac. So I show up, and they got a Mac, and all my systems wrong. And he got it all switched around and all working. Just did a great job. Really appreciate it. All right. So... when we want to talk about this first session, some of the changes that I see taking place in the world today and how that's going to impact how we do Avda in our life and work. And then we're going to get into very specific, I hope, applications on how some of this stuff can be worked out through the assignments that God has given you in and through your work in your church or your mission or whatever God has you specifically doing. Now, you notice I've completely avoided one word in the first 3 minutes here. What's that word?
Business.
No. Yes. Who said it? Tyler. Ministry. I've avoided that word. Why have I avoided that word?
Because of its connotations.
Because of its connotations, all right? I'm going to pick on Tyler again because we had dinner last night, and he knows what I'm going to say, right? But he, you know, in the midst of the conversation, he made the comment about being a full-time Christian worker. Was that what the term?
Or how,
I'm called into a full-time ministry or something like that. Now, you know why I got on him, right? Because I called a technical fall on him, right, like that. That's what I do with people. And helped, you know, us to learn, okay? Again, how do you think if, you know, I'm a normal business person, I know I'm abnormal, but as a normal business person, when we hear those kinds of things, we're feeling degraded. We're feeling second class, all right? And so I avoid using terms like ministry because often they're thinking the traditional view of ministry, and that means I'm not a part of that discussion. Okay? And so if I do use terms like that, I go to great lengths to make sure everyone in the room, whether they work for the church or whether they work for ExxonMobil or whether they work for the city, we're all a part of the discussion because we're all ministers in whatever we are assigned to do. Change. I don't have a picture of my grandchildren doing this yet because my son and daughter-in-law, I think very wisely, don't let my grandkids use screens. But this is the future, isn't it? I know, forget it. This is the present, all right? The present. I mean, many, many places I go, I see two-year-olds operating screens and pulling themselves through things. I even had one situation with my son's VCR when I was trying to watch a football game at Christmas that my granddaughter, who was two at the time, said, "Grandpa, it's like this." How does she know that? I mean, I know my son didn't teach her. I know my son doesn't give her those things to play with. How does she know that? It's kind of like, they're not millennials. They're literally pre-millennial, I guess, huh? Anyway, or post-millennial, I guess it'd be post-millennial. But the point being is that it's like they're born with this knowledge of how they do these things. It's just, it's crazy to us who are obviously over 60 how they do these things. But the world is changing in a way that we have to understand it's not going to be the way we want it to be. The internet, Wi-Fi, cell phones, and laptops. These four words did not exist when I graduated from college. They didn't exist. And we use those four words every single day of our lives now. They're central to everything that we do, the way we communicate, interact with one another. And the acceleration of change is going to continue to be way beyond us. I mean, this is my life, okay? You've got the personal, the laptop, and the handheld, right? Okay? How many of you know how to use an abacus? Am I the only one in this room? Okay, right. You remember? How many of you remember slide rules? Okay? I mean, you know, that was the computer that I learned to use to work with. And in fact, I remember when I was a senior, there was one, I think it was a science, chemistry, or a class where some of the wealthier people had, you know, these calculators, and the professor forbid them to use them because it obviously gave them an advantage over those like me who couldn't afford those things. So it's important. Now consider this. Six things here tried to conquer the world. Which one succeeded? Only Coca-Cola. Why? Why? That's it! Things go better with Coke. No, that's not it. Yes?
They made the customer feel like they were in control.
They made the customer feel like they're in control. And that's basically right. Because you see, when you look at products and merchandise, people welcome those things that they feel benefit their life. If we produce things that make people feel like, yes, they're in control, they're gaining something, they welcome us. But if we come in with something like the gospel or good news, which doesn't mean anything to them, especially Muslims who have their own religion, who have their own traditions, who have no need for the things that we know are most important, why would they welcome us? Why would they receive us? And this is exactly what Jesus did too. If you study the Gospels and study Jesus' life, there's no exception to this. He never, ever proclaims the kingdom of God before doing what? A miracle. Exactly. Always. He demonstrates who he is. He shows the product. This is valuable. This is good. You're going to need this. And of course, when you do a miracle, whoa, yeah. You healed my friend. You cured my mother-in-law. Whatever it is, that gets their attention. Now there's something here that's valuable. I'm going to listen. And so we need to understand the importance of providing goods and services that people want as door openers to get into unreached areas. Robert Morrison, the first missionary in the traditional form to go into China. How did he get in? He went as a translator for opium sellers. Now, a lot of people criticized him for that, but he said it was the only way to get the attention of the Chinese government leaders to be able to share the gospel with him. And through that, he was able to open up several ports to missionaries to penetrate into China. And so what we need to understand is what can often look like a threat is an opportunity. If we put these things into Jesus' hands, he can redeem them, and he can use them in a way that he will be glorified. Now, I want to talk about new wine a little bit, because we all know how much Jerry loves wine, and so I want to make sure, you know, that we keep him paying attention here, all right? So, Luke 5, neither is new wine put into old wineskins. If it is, the skins burst, and the wine is spilled, and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into new wineskins, and so both are preserved. Now, think about this. I just bought something at the store. It's a new bag. It's a new toy. It's a new something. Can something new be old? If you buy an old thing, it can be. But generally, you're new or you're old. You're not the same. Those are two very different concepts. New wine, old wine are extremely different. Jerry, you got a choice between new wine or old. What do you want?
Old.
Yeah, you are old. You want old. It's great that I get to pick on him in front of 50 people. I mean, this is really neat, you know. And Nan's not here, so somebody has to do it, right? No, I know she doesn't pick on you. We all love you a lot. All that to say, we love the old wine better. Why? Tastes better. Why does it taste better? Because it's aged. With age comes experience. With age comes expertise and understanding and all of these things that increase value. But think about what Jesus says, all right? He says, when we have new wine, we have to put it into new wineskins. Now, this is a picture of a wineskin. What the wineskins were in Jesus' day were literally goat skins. They would kill a goat to eat, they'd skin it, and they'd take the skin and they would tie off the 4 feet so that they wouldn't leak, and then using the neck, they would pour the new wine into the wineskin. And these wineskins are all fresh, never more than a day old, so they're very malleable, they're very moist. And when you pour in this fresh wine into the skin, what does the wine naturally do?
Expand.
It's expanding. It's fermenting, okay? It's bubbling. It's alive. When you're old, you're kind of dead. When you're new, you're alive, right? You know, you look at the old people, you know, and Jerry's not old. I mean, you look at the other old people, you know, and they kind of just sit there, right? What does a baby do? You know, they're wiggling all over, right? The wine is new, it's alive, and it's expanding, and because the skin is moist and young, it expands with the wine. But what happens as the wine begins to mature, it stops expanding, and the skin begins to harden. It's still very thin, but it's hard. And now once it's hard and the wine is aged a bit, they have a container that they can pour it out of into smaller jugs to pass around. And so this was the process that they used to ferment wine in Jesus' day. So when he talks about old wineskins, new wineskins, putting new wine into old wineskins, what happens if you take a brittle, thin goatskin and pour a live wine into it? It begins to expand and the goatskin cracks, bursts, and you lose all the wine. This is exactly what everyone in Jesus' day was familiar with, and this is how it all worked. But notice what Jesus' words say here, all right? It says, new wine must be put into new wineskins. And as things are changing around the world, I see many places and many organizations are trying to take the strategies that we've been using literally for 100 years and trying to implement them today. And we're seeing a lot of results, and we're going to talk about that in our second session, but these results are not lasting. They're not sticking. We're seeing a lot of seed sown in thorny and stony ground. It springs up, but then 10 years later, where are they? Where are they? As I've been watching, especially work in the Muslim world in the last 30 years, and I've seen how areas like Bangladesh and in India, especially those two, but somewhat in Africa, how we've gone in and we hear tremendous numbers of people coming to Christ back in the 90s. But today, where are the churches? Where's the impact in the community, in the governments, in the way people do business in society? And so we need to learn how to develop new wineskins for this new wine. Now, this is the way Jerry drinks it, like that. Right, Jerry? Because he uses the new wineskins, not the old. Consider, for example, the year is 1910. Tyler, you have four girls, right? Somebody told me they had eight kids. Who was that? Oh, Chris, right? All right. You want to get, well, his are younger, so maybe it's better for Tyler. You want to get the safest mode of transportation for your girls in 1910. Are you going to get a horse and buggy, or are you going to get an automobile? Probably a horse and buggy. Because in 1910, the automobile was very much a fad. It was for the rich. It was very unreliable. You didn't know it was going to start. You didn't know it was going to blow up. It was expensive. There were very few paved roads and very few gas stations. You get the horse and buggy. Let's fast forward just 15 years to 1925. Now what are you going to get, Tyler?
A car.
Because there's lots of paved roads, there's lots of gas stations, and the car is more efficient, it's faster, and it's reliable. I submit to you that today it's about 1915 in the age of missions. And if we continue to operate the way we have in the past, you're going to miss out. Because if you're working in 1910 and you're in the horse and buggy business, you'd better be transitioning into the automotive industry, because if you didn't and weren't, you are going to get left out. So as we look at the business world, and as we looked at the opportunities that are created through business, we have to understand the world situation. For example, give you two illustrations here. This is the first. How many of you would have a Muslim over to your home for dinner? All right, basically everybody, okay? Here's the Muslim. Why are you laughing? You think he's dead. I have friends who believe that's all an American hoax, that he's not dead. But what's... You know, if he were alive, would you have him over, or would you have his friends over? No, yes, okay.
I'd want to say yes.
You'd want to say yes, but I have four girls, right? Why the hesitancy? Safety, good. But why the hesitancy? Who is he? What does he represent? He represents terrorism. That's exactly right. Okay, what is a terrorist? Somebody who wants to change your religion, somebody who wants to change your way of life, and they want to do it by force. Does that sound about right? Sounds about right. Have you ever thought about how Muslims view missionaries? They're people who want to change their religion, who want to change their way of life, and we do it by force. Now you said, wait a minute, I don't know any missionaries that are throwing bombs or carrying, you know, Kalashnikovs around. I don't either. Missionaries use a much more powerful weapon than a gun. You know what that is? Money. Money. We go in and we say, hey, look, I'll set up a school for you. I'll set up a medical clinic for you. I'll get you free water. I'll get you whatever you need. Come and hear this story about Jesus. Come and learn about what we believe. There's a caveat. There's a hook. There's a bait and switch taking place that basically the vast majority of people working in the Muslim world do. And it's probably true in the Buddhist and Hindu world as well. And so how do the Muslims feel when they get this bait and switch?
Violated.
Very much so. Very much so. They get angry. How would you feel, Tyler? No, I'll use you, Chris. I've been picking on him all morning. Chris, what's your 16-year-old's name?
Matthew.
How would you feel if you came home from this trip and you found out that Matthew was hanging out with his Muslim friend, and in his Muslim friend's house, his parents were giving him all kinds of donuts and cakes and goodies to, you know, lure him in. He likes those things, I assume, pizza especially, if he's 16, but was also teaching them the Quran. How would you feel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm bothered by that. But that's exactly what we do overseas. That is exactly what we do. Ask your people, how do you get people to meet? How do you get them to gather? I teach them English. I give them food. I do things to lure them in, things that they want, so that I can share the gospel with them. And they feel violated. They feel angry. And the reason they hate Christians and they hate Americans are completely valid, from my perspective at least, because of the way we deal with them. We wouldn't want to be treated that way, but yet that's the way we treat them. That means we're violating whatsoever a man would do to you, do so to them, right? Yeah, we are sinning. We are sinning. We have built a foundation on sand. And is it any wonder that God isn't blessing us? We tell people we're there to do business, or we tell people we're there to help them, but that is not really what we're doing. We're lying. We're deceiving people, and we justify it because we're doing it in the name of Jesus. Because, yes, what Jerry's referring to is many people apply for a business visa so they can get into the country to do missionary work. When they're not doing business, and you're not doing business unless you're making money. Look it up in the dictionary. The definition of a business is a profit-making organization. If you're not paying yourself a salary through your business, you don't have a business. You have a platform. You have a fake business. Which means you're a fake. And another word for a fake is a lie. And another word for a lie is a sin. And another word for sin is separation from Jesus. You understand? We have built an entire outreach program on sand. And we wonder why Muslims are so difficult to come to Jesus. You wonder why the lesbian, gay community is so difficult to come to Jesus. Because we do the same things here in North America, don't we? Same things. We're afraid to be transparent. We're afraid to be loving as Jesus loved. We're afraid to allow Him to work through us because we're afraid. We're afraid. And it is tough. I know just this morning in my own quiet time, the Lord was reminding me of something that I was afraid of, and I still kind of am afraid of, and that is entrusting my grandchildren to Him. You heard me yesterday, right? I almost broke down and cried. Because I pray for these kids. I prayed a lot for them this morning. The future is really scary from my perspective. The good news is, my perspective doesn't matter. And so entrusting them to Him, though, is a challenge for me. So, second illustration. That's me. No, it's not. When I was prepared, first in the Navigator, second in seminary, I always get those two mixed up. In seminary, I was taught how to preach the gospel. Four spiritual laws, Roman road, bridge illustration. I can do them all backwards and forwards. I've got all the verses memorized. I learned all these tools and all these methodologies. And I took these tools and methodologies, and first on the university campus, we saw a lot of people come to Christ and discipled And I'm thrilled that most of them I'm still in touch with, and they're still walking with God. Then we went overseas, first to the Chinese world, and we saw lots of people come to Christ, almost 90, over 90, between 90 and 100, our first 4 years working with Chinese. It was an exhilarating time, and I told you a little bit about some of the people we discipled there. But then we moved to the Muslim world. And as we moved into the Muslim world, things were different. Nobody welcomed us. Nobody listened to us. Nobody prayed to receive Christ. We didn't see the response that we saw in North America. We didn't see the response that we saw in the Chinese world. Just blank stares, or why do we want to do that, or why are you here? Do you have money for me? Do you have English for me? Do you have a ticket to America for me? Apart from that, they didn't care. They didn't care. What do you have for me? And as I began to struggle with this and try to discern what is God doing wrong, now think about that, I'm joking, I realized he was not the problem. The Word of God's not the problem. So there's only one other variable here that's the problem. And that was moi, right? That I was taking strategies and doing things because I had a traditional mission approach. I'd set up a business. I'd registered it with the government. And I was in the country legally. But I wasn't doing any business at all. But I was telling everybody I was. Because that's what my visa said. And because my visa said that, I felt I was speaking the truth when I had no intent to. And as I began to understand these things and I began to feel some guilt about it, we had seen a couple of Muslims come to faith. One of them was named Zul. And Zul would come over to my house regularly. And we'd study the Word together, and he was beginning to grow, and he was baptized and become a good friend. And one day he said to me, he said, Patrick, why are you always home? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, where's your office? I said, well, Americans often work out of our homes. Now, in Southeast Asia, nobody does that, but I was doing that because I didn't want to pay for an office. I didn't need an office because I really wasn't doing business. So Zul pressed in a little. He said, well, why don't you get an office? And I said, well, I don't really need one for what I do. And he said, so, but what kind of business are you really doing? And so I said to him, well, Zul, let me tell you the truth. If you ever have to say that to anybody, just get down on your knees right away and start repenting. So it took me a little while to figure this out, just a few days, not long. But Zul, I said to him, I said, the truth is, I am here legally, I've registered a business, I have a visa, I'm not doing anything illegal, but it's really all set up, it's all designed so that we can share the gospel with you, your friends, and your family. And then I literally said, isn't that wonderful? And he looked at me and said, so you've been lying to everybody. It was like the Holy Spirit just shot an arrow right through my heart. And I just kind of crumbled. I didn't fall, but I just kind of, whoa. The veneer's been broken. The facade has been taken down. And we ended the discussion because I certainly wasn't in the mood to talk. And I spent the next almost day and a half just saying, Lord, okay, is this the problem? Yeah. You're trying to share the truth based on a lie. You can't do that. I'm not going to honor it. And this is why throughout the Muslim world, we're not seeing results. Because we're going to these people with a lie, and Jesus isn't going to honor it. It's not their problem. It's our problem. It's our problem. And so what we begin to learn as we then moved into business, because if we said we're going to do business, we're going to do real business. And I had tremendous grace poured upon me because literally 2 weeks after that discussion with Zul, I was arrested and kicked out of Indonesia. And that was tremendous grace because my wife, who has an MBA and I had a business background, said, well, if we're going to move to Malaysia, where we wanted to go next, because we couldn't go back to Singapore, we couldn't stay in Indonesia, and Malaysia is the same language, very different culture, but same language, we'd have to do real business. The Lord wasn't giving us the freedom to go home. We had no member care in those days, so we were all on our own. In fact, it was years later, my son was sitting in our living room in Malaysia, and I was doing some training with some American short-term workers, when I realized, I never debriefed my son. He watched that whole instance of me being arrested, taken out by the police and customs officials, and we never debriefed him on it. I'm sitting there like, whoa, we never discussed that with you, did we? And he's like, no, it didn't matter. You know why it didn't matter? He said, I knew God was in that. Now, if you know my son, I hope you can come to Kansas City and meet my son. I mean, he's really special. But anybody who works with a Pushtu's got to be special, right? For those who weren't here yesterday, that's the Taliban. And we're still looking for single women, okay? We had one volunteer yesterday, but I think she was a little older than my son, so still looking. Jerry says he'll match you up.
I will.
He will, all right. But your parents better be on board, okay? All that to say, as we began to do business in Malaysia, things totally changed. All of a sudden, I wasn't afraid of the government officials. They could be my friends. I could be forthright with them. I could be honest with them. I could be upright and totally transparent with them. And the people, nobody asked me after the first week, what are you doing here? Because, you know, when you're 6'4" and white in a world of brown, everybody knows what you're doing. I go places all the time. Even now when I'm gone 8 months out of the year, I'm like, how do people still remember me? I've been doing this for 9 years. But when I go back home, I go to a wedding or someplace, and I'll introduce myself, and they say, oh, I know who you are. You know, you own the language center over there. Yeah, and they know all about me. Because that's the way it works. But that's great, because they're watching me, and they're seeing Jesus in the midst of that. And so the first thing that I realized is, as we begin to work together, people begin, oh, no, there it is. Okay, I thought that we were going to get that. The thing they begin to realize is the way I dealt with people was different. When a supplier would short us or a customer would lie to us, I would say, you know, our employees would get mad. You know, one guy even one time said, should I go slash their tires? No. We're not going to do that. Why not? Well, the reason is because I don't think that's what Jesus would do. What? Jesus again? Because every person that we hire before they come to work for us, Buddhist, Hindu, and Muslim, we've had them all work for us, we tell them, we run our business according to the principles of the Bible. And if you don't want to work for a business like that, don't work for us. And we've never, ever had anybody turn down a job. Not one. In fact, I think the average length of time that our people work for us is around 9 years. They love working for us. In fact, many of them, when they leave with tears, but they're leaving. In fact, one woman, I literally had to almost kick her out because she was offered such a prestigious job in her hometown. Something I knew she really wanted to do was go back and work in her hometown, making twice the amount of money that I was paying her, but she loved working for us so much. She didn't come to faith, but she was close. She was close, and I'm hoping that she'll still come. But the key is they see forgiveness. They see forgiveness. Another thing they see is grace. When they do shoddy work, when they come in late repeatedly, and I'll sit them down and I say, now look, you know, this is the standard, right, right. So you're not meeting the standard. Is there a problem? Well, this or that, whatever their excuse is. And I say, well, look, Jesus wants me to extend to you grace. Do you know what grace is? First time around, they don't know. Second time around, they do. But I want to extend grace to you. In fact, our office manager, her name is Sue, after experiencing a lot of things, having worked for us for 4 years, I won't tell her whole story, but this is just one part of the grace thing. At the end of the month, we would always go out for lunch, usually to a Japanese restaurant downstairs. I do eat healthy sometimes, Jerry, when, you know, you're not around. And we'd go down to this restaurant. It's in our building. And we'd have lunch. And the owners know us, so they give us a table off to the side. And we'd sit there and work for about 2 hours and review all of our employees. We have 19 full-time employees. And who needs a bonus? Who needs some correction? You know, just discussing all of them, that kind of stuff. And because the next day we do the paychecks. And in talking with her one time, one of our employees named Ramat, he was underperforming. And we'd extended him grace at least twice. And so Sue said to me, it's time we fire Ramat. And I said, no, I think we need to extend him grace one more time. And she's like, you Christians in your grace, you need to fire him. And I said, no, I really think God wants to extend us grace to him one more time. She said, no. I said, Sue, you know what grace is? She said, yeah, I know. You've told me many times. I said, so what is it? She said, well, it's when, you know, somebody does something for you that you don't deserve. I said, well, yeah, that's right, but let me share with you again. So I laid out the gospel for, again, probably the seventh or eighth time that she'd heard it. And after we finished, and this is how you know I'm a terrible evangelist, she said to me, can we get back to work now? So back to work we went. But the next day, as I'm writing checks for our employees, I came to Sue's name, and I give bonuses quite a bit, but usually they're about the equivalent of 10 U.S. dollars, okay? We're always looking for good things to reward people and give them a bonus, okay? And so I came to her name, and I thought, oh, man. And God just said, yeah, that's what you need to do. We give $100 bonuses for something really phenomenally well. I mean, something exceptional. We maybe five times a year, we give a $100 bonus. So when I came to Sue's check, I wrote a bonus check, $100. Put it in her envelope after all the envelopes are done. Sue comes in, she takes them, she distributes them to everybody. And as I expected, after she distributed all the envelopes, she comes, sits down at her desk. And through my door, I can see her desk. And so I sat down, I watched her open the envelope, and as expected, one check. Oh, what's the second check? Oh, a bonus check. And I immediately turned and faced the wall. And as expected, she comes into my office and says, hey, boss, thanks for the bonus. What did I do? And I keep looking at the wall, and I said, nothing. She said, oh, come on, what do I do? You know, because they always want to do it again, right? And I said, Sue, you didn't do anything. She said, come on, tell me, because we do joke around a lot. So when she asked the second time, I turned around and I looked at her and I said, Sue, you remember our discussion about grace yesterday? She said, yeah. I said, Sue, you really didn't do anything. You don't deserve this apart from the fact that God has told me to extend this grace to you. She just froze. That was a Friday. Monday morning, she came into the office and she said, boss, can you get me a copy of your book? I want to read it. Took a while, but 4 years later, we baptized Sue, her husband, and her whole family. That's how it works. That's how it works. But they need to see grace. They also need to see that God is personal. Bible on my desk. Every morning, I come into the office, I sit down and I open the Bible. I had my quiet time at home. I have a big glass wall in my office. That's intentional. Because I want everybody to see. I'm not spending time with God, I am. But what I'm really doing is I'm witnessing to the workers that the priority is Jesus. When I come into the office in the beginning, you know, some people meet me at the door. I got a question for you. I say, got to talk to the CEO first, and then I'll talk to you. And they see that. I only take a minute or three, not very long. But I want them to continually remember Jesus is the reason I'm doing business. They need to understand. He's personal. He's involved in the things that we do. And then love is extremely important. Going to their kids' parties, visiting them when they're sick, giving bonuses, remembering their birthdays and anniversaries. And we'll talk about some of these things in the next session. But extending love to them in a way that they understand, in a way that they receive it. Not the way I understand and I receive it, but in the way they do. causes them to see something that they don't see in other bosses. They don't see in other coworkers. You don't have to be the business owner. You just need to be involved in working with the people. Uh-oh. What are you seeing? Oh, okay. Oh, these are working? They didn't work yesterday. That's why I didn't do it that way. Uh-oh, we're going to have problems because I set this up differently today. Okay, so as we look at business, okay, yeah, you got to catch up. Oh, that's why you're having the problem. You need to catch up with the screen. That's the problem. Okay, got it. When we look at doing business, why do we do business? Credibility. Doing business gives me credibility with everybody. It also gives me respect with people. I have favor with the government. They want me there. I've got a legal visa. It's biblical, as we saw yesterday. I make money. I make money. Churches, you don't have to pay us. We make money. Which one just came up? I have an identity that's understood. I get to model the gospel. I get relationships with people. And it's a reproducible model. I'm contextualized in what I do. All of these things are given to me by simply doing business. But in the mission world, these are all things I'm trying to do, I'm trying to prefabricate, because they don't come with being a missionary. But when you do business, they all just come naturally. How you dress, how you live, your salary sets that. And it's completely understandable to everybody. And this is another reason I love business. I don't have to pretend. I can be integrate, I can be honest, and I can be forthright in everything that I do. Some core values for both our organization and how we work. Relationships are front and center. And I think we talked about this yesterday. I've spoken so many times this week, I may be confusing, but we talked about how the greatest commandment, right, is to love God and then to love one another. And it's in relationship that everything has to happen. Secondly, I got the verse there, is accountability. We need to have real accountability. Now, I was very impressed yesterday to hear that 2.2 million people came to Christ through your ministries. But I want to see the names of all 2.2 million people. And I'm serious. Because I've been in missions a long, long time. I've got my doctorate in it, so I've got a little bit of expertise. You know what an expert is. An X is a has-been, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. And I've seen a lot of numbers thrown around. I'm in 20... to 30 countries every year, and it's amazing how many times I visit a church in the United States who says, oh man, have you heard about what's happening in Kazakhstan? Oh, really? What's happening? Not knowing I was just there last week. And it's amazing the number of things that are reported over here. For example, before I was in Kazakhstan, I was in Turkey, and I was there for 2 weeks, not just one. And I met with a lot of our people in Turkey. Turkey, we probably have 15 businesses in that country. And I know a number of you have been getting emails about a pastor in Turkey. Right? No? Some of you, okay? You know what I'm talking about. Well, my people in Turkey say every single charge against him is true. They're not lies, as is being reported in the press here, especially the Christian press. And some of these people know him personally. But you're being told they're lies. And to send money and to pray for him. Because this pastor is being persecuted by the Turkish government for illegal things that have been drummed up charges, is what I read here in the United States. But when I ask the guys over there, they're like, no, those are exactly the things he's done, and that's exactly why we don't do those things, and that's exactly why we do business, because we don't want to offend the government. And so we need to be aware of these things, and I want names. When I showed you those pictures of churches planted earlier, I can give you the names of the people who are leading those churches. And you can contact them and follow up because we need real accountability. It's very easy to throw up big figures. It's really hard to come up with the names, isn't it? And when I show pictures, one of the things you want to do, pastors, you get missionaries come home, show you pictures. As they're showing their pictures, stop the picture and say, name everybody in that picture. And if they can't name everybody in that picture, guess what? They're probably a guest at the wedding. They're probably a guest at the baptism. They're probably a guest at the event. But they don't know anybody. That's not their work. I don't claim the work of my disciples' disciples. The churches that we've planted through my disciples, yes, I feel I have a direct involvement. I mean, nothing makes me more thrilled than going back to some of the churches that disciples we've worked with have planted and hearing the guys say, hey, I'm your great-grandson spiritually. I'm your great-great-grandson spiritually. Man, that really lights me up. But if those guys go and plant a church, I don't count it. I don't count. Why should I count that? That's not the work God is doing through me. That's the work God is doing through my disciple's disciple. We're so caught up in numbers. Consider this. Jesus sent all of his disciples on short-term trips. Short-term trips are good. They get exposure. They get experience. But when they came back, the first question Jesus asked them, do you remember? It was this. How many people did you baptize? Was that the first question? He didn't even ask the question. Did he? We are so caught up in numbers. Why are we so caught up in numbers? Because we're Greek in our thinking. We're not Hebrew. We need to rethink our priorities. I'm doing a study right now with Devin and two other people on our team where we're looking at the metrics of Jesus. What does Jesus judge? How does he evaluate? And as I've been going at least through my portion so far, I'm almost done, he doesn't use numbers. Now, you want a real challenge, Michael? Because I've done this with my team, and this is almost impossible. Set goals and objectives based on justice, righteousness, godliness, truth, love, the character qualities to which God calls us to, and don't use any numbers. It is really hard. But that's the way Jesus decides. I'm trying to shape an organization that we decide the same way he does. Now, I tell you, it's tough. Because we got 2,000 years of doing it another way. But I think it's time we changed. I think it's time we get back to doing things the way he does. I think my battery's dying up here, but anyway, we'll make it through this talk. So holding people accountable in their character, and in their marriage, in their church planting, in their family, in their finances, in their language and culture learning, in their business, in their relationships with people. These are all things that we are insistent on holding people accountable for. Security is often an issue of people. Transparency is what we're longing for. What we've learned, if we are transparent, we don't have a security problem. When there's nothing to hide, you don't have to hide anything. That's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? But it's the truth. You don't have to worry about security. You don't have to worry about who you may think you are. This is one of our businesses in the Middle East. Notice what's up on the wall there. He has 33 Muslim Arab employees working for him. He starts every day. He has a meeting at 10 o'clock. It's an IT business, so he allows flex hours, but everybody has to be there at 10 o'clock. And every day he starts by pointing at this sign and reminding them that work is worship. Mavda. Whether you're Muslim, whether you're Hindu, whether you're Buddhist, especially if you're Jewish, they get it. They get it. This is what we're supposed to do. And we're church-centered. Everything we do out of local churches. We don't work with mission agencies, and that's intentional. because we don't see the parachurch as the bride of Christ. And I talked about that yesterday. And lastly, everything we do absolutely perfect. That's not true. But that is Jesus' standard, isn't it, in Matthew 5:48? You, therefore, must be perfect. But we recognize we're not going to achieve that until we meet him face to face. So the next best thing is excellence. We strive for excellence. And so there's a lot of things we don't do. We don't do member care. We don't channel finances. We don't do insurance. We don't do those things because we outsource them, because there's others who are doing those things with excellence. Why should we do something if somebody else is doing it with excellence? But the things we do, I do think we do better than anybody else, because what we've done is we've gone to different organizations that provide different services like training, like finances, like member care, and we outsource to those people so that the people we work with are getting the absolute best services. Our process looks a lot like this. So pastors, you can see it. I had a flow chart, but I can't get it to mesh with the thing here. So I'm just going to point here, and you guys can hopefully follow with me over there too. But if somebody approaches us, they come to us, they're introduced to a mentor in their church simultaneously. We check with their church, and we begin to bring the church into discussion. Now, Jimmy's gone through this process with us. Jerry's gone through this process with us. I don't think anybody else in your network has, but they can validate that we do this. And then if they need an internship, notice that's a different color arrow there, they go for an internship. If they don't need an internship, we come back to the church, and we literally meet with the church leader to discuss the individual, to make sure the church is behind the couple or individual. And if the church is not, we don't process them. We don't work with them. Because it's the church that sends. But if they are, then they go for an apprenticeship. An apprenticeship can be 2, 3, 4 years, depending upon how long it takes the couple or individual to accomplish their goals and objectives. And once that's completed, then they're released to either start their own business or to work in another business or to do whatever God is leading them to do. But the onus is put on the church. I mean, Jimmy and I are having lunch today because we're talking about their couple in the church who's had a few hiccups in their journey. And we're trying to discern, are those God's hiccups or are those their hiccups? And if they're their hiccups, obviously Jimmy and us are going to have to figure out what God wants them to really do. But the thing is, we're doing it with the church, because it's the church that sends all the people we work with. So we're trying to do things differently. We're trying to get rid of a lot of the unnecessary baggage to put people in a place where they can truly obey God and succeed in the assignments he's given them. This is one of my favorite quotes. The illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. I'm told that those who are studying engineering in university today, what they start learning as a freshman is already obsolete by the time they're a senior. Business practices are constantly changing. Young people especially, you are going to have to be masters at learning and unlearning and relearning things. One thing I do thank God for is I'm just over the hump, so maybe I don't have to do so much unlearning, but I've had to do a lot. I mean, everything I'm sharing today is not things that I was naturally inclined to do when I first went overseas especially. But I've learned that a little spark, a little fire, often turns into something much bigger. And I know as we push one another, encourage one another, build up one another, in moving forward, we can do these things better in a way that truly glorifies God by working together hand in hand with one another. God will be glorified amongst all peoples. Patrick, yes, Jerry.
Would you comment too on the emphasis on accountability and open network?
Would I comment on accountability in the open network? Okay, I showed you briefly the slide, you know, with the different 9 areas that we provide accountability for. Each person has a mentor, or each couple has a couple that mentors them. And our people are to be communicating by, you know, there's hundreds of ways to communicate nowadays, but communicating on a weekly basis with their people, not just, you know, through email, but by voice every 2 to 3 weeks to make sure they're being followed up, make sure they're moving forward, because each person sets goals and objectives in these 9 areas. And the mentor's job is not to tell them what to do, but to guide them in the process of what God is leading them to do with the approval of the church. That's why Jimmy and I are meeting. Because we're going to tell this couple to do anything unless Jimmy's on board. Now, sometimes Jimmy says, look, Patrick, I trust you. You tell him what to do. That's fine. But the authority comes through him, not through me. There's a chain of command that God has clearly given us. And so we want to work within that, because I've learned when we moved outside of that and made the parachurch God, he apparently blesses. But when I study the apparent, we see a lot of thorny and a lot of stony seeds springing up. Why isn't this lasting for eternity? I used to play semi-pro basketball. I blew this knee out. I mean, blew it out. Look at me. Why am I like this? After 6 years of intense pain, not being able to kneel, not being able to do much with it, God healed it. I was in a prayer meeting. The pastor said, somebody here's got a knee that needs healing. And I'm like, you know, it's never for you, right? So I just sat there thinking, boy, somebody's lucky. And then after a minute or two, he said, you know, I'm sure God has somebody here whose knee needs to be healed. And I'm just like, well, gosh, who is that lucky guy? I didn't move. But then he said it the third time. And he says the third time, my knee starts going like that. I wasn't doing it. I'm like, is that for me? And I go forward. Look, that was 19 years ago. When God heals, it's healed. When God saves, it's saved. But we're doing a lot of saving out there. Think about it. If they're not sticking, it wasn't Jesus' work. We blame the devil, but a lot of times we need to blame us, because we're sowing seed, and we're going to talk about this in about 10 minutes. We're sowing seed in thorny and stony ground, and we're getting exactly what Jesus promised, temporary fruit. And that's where numbers are the death of us, because we count these things, and we think it's so wonderful, and then 10 years later, nobody comes back and recounts. Because if we did, we'd be shocked. Shocked.